Deutschland! Die Heil! Deutschland! Die Heil! Deutschland! Die Heil! Deutschland! Die Heil! Deutschland! Die Heil!
The following is a community service message brought to you by the Shieldwall Network as a piece of friendly advice to all white nationalists and members of the alt-right who are considering activism, whether public or online. The great white nationalist leader, Tom Metzger, in his advocacy of lone wolf activism exclusively, made some points which I agree with and some points which I do not. However, one point that he made, which I certainly do agree with, is his advocacy of what he called the five words. And the five words are simply, I have nothing to say. The five words, I have nothing to say, are especially applicable when discussing anything from whether the sky is blue to what you are doing with any law enforcement officer, from a local to a state or federal level. You are well within your rights to say only those five words, I have nothing to say, and, if pressed, to demand the presence of a lawyer and to maintain your silence. Most people who are convicted or pressured into taking a plea agreement are pressured into taking that plea or convicted because of things they themselves have said, either to others or directly to law enforcement. Therefore, you are always better off to maintain the five words, I have nothing to say. This protected constitutional right against self-incrimination, the Fifth Amendment, means that we also should take the advice of our founding fathers and consider it to be a good idea not to voluntarily incriminate ourselves. What this means is that we should think long and hard before we grant any interviews to the media, and especially whenever they ask us any questions about any information which is not already available online. This even extends to discussing other white nationalists and alt-right members. As all of you know, I have a great contempt and enmity for Andrew England, who is a anti-white woman, misogynist, race-mixing mongolophile, and basically a piece of shit as far as I'm concerned. But despite my personal opinion of Andrew Anglin, when I was contacted by Luke O'Brien, the Huffington Post reporter, who was waging some kind of really creepy social media war against Andrew, I not only declined to comment and to do as Luke O'Brien had asked and to help him with some information about Andrew Anglin, I basically told him to go piss up a tree. And then I told him Merry Christmas. We should not allow others to do our house cleaning for us. We should always take out our own trash. And so, you should avoid joking about or discussing doing anything illegal, whether drunk or sober. You should dissuade anyone else from having such discussions, and you should not openly discuss other people having such discussions. Part of being disciplined and part of an organization is that you follow the chain of command and follow the directions that are given to you, and that you not spread rumors about other members of that organization or other people in the larger white nationalist or even the big tent alt-right community. So, the Fifth Amendment gives you the right to not self-incriminate, and the five words instruct you to say, I have nothing to say, both of which are not only your rights, but very good advice. While we avoid doing anything illegal, for example, the Shieldwall Network openly and actively discourages any illegal drug use or any discussion, even jokingly, of any illegal actions, we also don't want to incriminate others or incriminate ourselves, whether falsely or truly, or even create the insinuation or the appearance of any illegality through spreading rumors. or through backbiting, or through gossip, especially once it's been established that that's not at all constructive or desired. So, the way that you handle agents provocateur who want to discuss illegal things is by being clear to them that you're not interested in doing any illegal things or talking about any illegal things, and do not do any illegal things, even casual illegal things, with anyone, especially someone that you might suspect of being an agent provocateur or an informant. That's just basic common sense. So, if you follow those rules, you can, like myself, knock on wood so far, avoid spending a lot of time in prison. So, practice the five words. I have nothing to say. Don't share incriminating videos of yourself involved in any illegal activity or pictures or brag about things that you may have done or you might like to do. And don't participate in any illegal activities or discussion of illegal activities with anyone. That will make it a lot harder for our enemies and a lot easier for our ultimate victory. This has been a community service announcement brought to you by the Shield Wall Network.
You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Cause the fire acts out to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We'll send a wedding full of clowns. And we'll kick them while they're down. Give the banks control, cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America. The best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls and children of all ages, to the Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast for the taint of 2017. That's right, we're right here at the tail end of the year, in the taint where it's just past Christmas and not quite to New Year's Eve as we get ready for 2018. Over the next couple of weeks, I'll be bringing to you my personal predictions about the political and cultural ramifications of the coming new year and what we can expect coming up as the old man passes away and the baby bounces in for 2018. But this week's The Rope Report, we have to talk about not what was up under the Christmas tree or what we can expect for next year yet. We have to talk about what happened in Memphis. And so this episode of The Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, is titled The Memphis Mafia. Now, the term the Memphis Mafia goes back to the label that was put on Elvis Presley's entourage and his friends who followed him around and hung out with him there at Graceland. And it kind of epitomizes the importance of Memphis to Southerners in the Central South like myself. And it all goes back really to my childhood and even further. You know, the Nathan Bedford Forrest statue was erected in 1904. And the Jefferson Davis statue there was erected in 1964. And I was born in 1972. I always grew up thinking of Memphis as being a huge city, the largest city in our region, much larger than Little Rock, for example. And the city, which was predominantly black, it was like going to safari to go to Memphis, but there were still some diamonds in the feces, if you will, some nice things about Memphis. I remember that when I was a kid, my dad, who's now passed away, would have waterworks conventions in Memphis, and we would go with him, and we often stayed at the Peabody Hotel. It's a downtown, beautiful, ornate hotel with a classical piano played in the lobby and a very nice Olympic indoor pool and a shopping mall inside. A very five-star hotel, very upper crust, and it was very impressive for a young boy, I can tell you, to see the elevator doors open and the ducks marched out across the red carpet to swim and splash around in the lobby fountain, which was one of the signatures of the Peabody Hotel. So I really enjoyed staying there and walking around Memphis with my family and going to the big Memphis Zoo. Most importantly, going to Graceland. You know, Elvis died when I was about 6 years old, but like all Southern boys, he played an important part in our heritage and our culture and in my young adulthood. I'm really into rockabilly and always have been, and a big Elvis fan, as many of you know. But going to Graceland as a little kid and doing the tour of his house and going on the candlelight vigil on his birthday, being there, seeing his grave. I still have pictures of myself when I was about 8 years old standing at Elvis's grave. It's a very culturally important thing. Now, Graceland is right in the middle of Niggertown. It's expanded and enveloped it, really kind of like an amoeba spreading across a healthy area of pond, or maybe a cancer cell swallowing up a healthy cell. The black neighborhood of South Memphis has swallowed up Graceland as well. And the last time that we went there was really only about 2 months ago. We were on the way back from the Stormfront Conference in Central Tennessee, where I spoke after helping to organize it. And, you know, we'd had a long day, obviously. And before we actually got into Memphis, it was starting to get dark. My wife had never been to Graceland before, and we'd only driven through Memphis a couple of times. You see, when you live in Arkansas, Memphis is kind of like a border town. It's a marker, a landmark, if you will, because when you come through Memphis, and you definitely stay on the Beltway if you have a choice, you don't get off unless you have to, unless you're really going south into the casinos south of town or stopping for some specific site. You stay right there on the main roads because you can see you're driving through ghetto. And then the large buildings rise up around you, and to your right, you see the huge new Bass Pro Shops pyramid, all gleaming glass. And then you start to rise up on the bridge, and you see that you're going across the widest river on our continent, the Mississippi River. And so as you go through Bluff City, one of the nicknames for Memphis, the city by the river, and you start to cross over the Mississippi River, you really look down on that mile-wide stretch of brown water, and you look ahead of yourself, and you know that you're getting back home halfway across the bridge. You see the sign, and you're back home in Arkansas. So for me, Memphis has always been a sign of coming home, especially when I lived in West Virginia, when I worked for Dr. Pierce and the National Alliance, and I would often come home to visit. And every time that I came home from the east half of the country, I would drive through Memphis. And so it was always a symbol of me coming home finally. And so Memphis, you know, is important to Southerners, despite the fact that it's now a majority black cesspool. And as we got close to Memphis, as it started to get dark, I wanted to have my wife the opportunity to visit Graceland. And we made it, and we found it. I actually was trying to use a GPS on my phone and trying to use my memory and trying to use signs. And it was about dark when we got into Memphis, into the area, which was not necessarily heartening or encouraging. I actually stopped for directions at a McDonald's that was 100% nigger. And, you know, it's the kind of place where you stop and lock the car and walk in as quickly as possible. And they're trying to beg you for change and for cigarettes and looking at you like they know that you're definitely in the wrong part of town. But I found Memphis, and we were able to take some pictures there by the gate and show her actually Graceland itself through the gate and over the fence, and went to a souvenir shop there and walked around, spent some time. So at least she got to see Graceland, even though it was already closed and we did not get to take the tour. We discussed possibly going back someday and taking the tour of it. She's not as big of an Elvis fan as I am because she's from the North. She's from Detroit. And she actually reacted the way that she would have if she was back home around 8 Mile and told me that it was very much like the overwhelmingly non-white neighborhoods and areas of Detroit that she grew up in. So obviously, even she noticed that Memphis is now a third world city. Very sad. And there are still some very good people in the Memphis area, like James Edwards, who runs the political cesspool program, and some other patriots that I could name, but which are not public figures, so I won't. But on the most part, Memphis is no longer our city. And that was proven solidly last Wednesday. Now, the last time that I had seen and been to the Nathan Bedford Forrest statue there by the university, which I think they had renamed something like Health and Sciences Park to try to take the curse off of it, was about 3 years ago when I went with Pastor Thomas Robb and other members of the Knights Party to the American Heritage Cultural Festival in Pulaski, Tennessee, which is the birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan. And since the Ku Klux Klan was actually founded by General Nathan Bedford Forrest after the Civil War during what we call the Radical Reconstruction, which for those of you who might need a brief history lesson, the Ku Klux Klan was founded because after the American Civil War, Union federal troops occupied the South and treated it like enemy territory, were very cruel and inhumane, burned our crops, burned our homes, raped our women, and disallowed white males from being allowed to vote or to hold public office, and basically brought in completely illiterate former slaves and put them in charge of the state governments and the state legislature and backed them up at bayonet point. So many Southerners literally starved to death for several years. That last scene of Gone with the Wind, you know, when they're digging up turnips. Well, now that's pretty realistic. And if they were lucky to have turnips, a lot of Southerners ended up eating all the wild game in their area and then wishing they had more. It was a lean time for our people, a time when we learned to make do with very little, a time which really shaped our culture as well because we learned to value food as being a symbol of society and culture and generosity and gratitude and community. A lot of people wonder why in the American South food is so important to our culture. Whenever we have someone come in to visit, we offer them food. If we are not offered food, it's seen as an insult. And if we don't have food to offer, it's considered a humiliation. We form a lot of our culture around food because for a generation, literally, we had no food. We were much like the Boers in South Africa in comparison to the British after the Anglo-Boer War was there. We were treated much the same way as far as concentration camps and starvation methods that they used to defeat us. So, if you look at the relationship between the Boers and the English in South Africa, or the relationship between the Irish and the English in the United Kingdom, then you might understand better the relationship between Southern white Americans and Northern white Americans, which still lingers in our ancestral memory to this day. And so the Ku Klux Klan was founded in the years immediately following the end of the American Civil War in the area that we call the radical reconstruction of the South, the military occupation of the South as an enemy alien province, in order to defend white Southerners and especially white Southern women from federal troops and from the blacks, the former slaves, which had been placed in charge of and on top of whites in the South. And Nathan Bedford Forrest being the leader of and founder of the first Ku Klux Klan, as well as a great military hero, is honored in Pulaski, Tennessee, each year by the Knights Party. And so I had traveled with Pastor Thomas Robb and other Knights Party members to Pulaski, Tennessee, for that festival. And on the way there, actually, a guy that I really miss, a guy named Randall Fuqua, who hosted a website called No Kikes, who was strongly anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish, had a great sense of humor, a big former Marine, great guy, a friend of mine. He's passed away now. He passed away of cancer a few years ago. But he and I were driving a U-Haul truck full of all the equipment that the Knights Party was taking over to Pulaski for the festival and the celebration. And we were driving through Memphis, and we got hit by a vehicle that was not running. It's kind of an interesting story. We were driving through Memphis, and we were really at the intersection by the Sun Records recording studio. The Sun Records recording studio, actually, where back in the 50s, Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins recorded their hits for the first time. And we were stopped at the stoplight, and suddenly we felt something hit the back of the van, and we didn't know what had happened. We thought maybe something had shifted back in the cargo bed, so I got out to look. And lo and behold, it was three niggers pushing a Cadillac that was out of gas across the intersection in the middle of traffic, and they had lost control over it because none of them were steering, and they steered this out-of-gas, non-running Cadillac into the back of our U-Haul. And it was really a stereotype and a cliche, but it actually happened in real life. And every time that I think of Memphis, I think of Randall and miss him. But we made it through Memphis on that way, and we came back through Memphis and actually stopped at the park where Nathan Bedford Forrest and his wife were buried there under the statue of him on the horse there by the university, the very statue that they removed Wednesday night. And myself and Pastor Thomas Robb and some others there visited Nathan Bedford Forrest's grave and the statue there. And that was the last time that I actually went to the statue. I and my wife drove by the statue after we visited Graceland, but it was already dark, and so we did not actually stop. I wish now that I had, because it's not there anymore. It's gone. So here's what happened. Basically, in 2013, because the blacks had gained control of Memphis, and they had begun talking about taking down these monuments and statues, the state of Tennessee, the state legislature, made a move to try to preserve it and other cultural and historical landmarks. The Tennessee Heritage Protection Act, which was passed in 2013 and amended in 2016, prohibited the removal, the relocation, or the renaming of any memorial that's on public property. So Jim Strickland, the cucked anti-white rhino mayor of Tennessee, who's always been hand-in-hand with the niggers there, worked with the majority non-white city council, who began to try to work with Van Horn, one of the black city council members, and this organization led by black anti-white activists in Memphis, like Tammy Sawyer, that was called Take 'em Down 901, to create another private group led by that Van Forrest, just basically a fake private entity that would then be able to buy for $1,000 each the two city parks in Memphis, one of which had the statue of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, and the other having the equestrian statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest. And that private entity named Memphis Green Space Incorporated, which, you know, was just created for this insidious purpose and led by blacks, was allowed to purchase last Friday in a secret private deal the two parks for $1,000 each, The mayor signed the deal, and then last Wednesday at the city council meeting, without the public knowing, without anyone being told ahead of time, without anyone having a chance to get a private injunction or a federal warrant to slow the removal of statues, they voted to sell both the parks to the private entity, which the mayor had already signed on. And then they immediately sent Memphis Police Department officials, officers, by the dozens out to secure both parks and to make sure that no one could go there to protest or to block the cranes from coming in and removing the statues. And while the police were en route, before they had even continued their meeting, the Memphis City Council unanimously voted to remove those statues. And they began to remove the statues immediately. They already had the moving companies, the cranes, on hand, ready to go, because they'd planned this all out ahead of time. And that's why they held the city council meeting after hours, so that the white citizens or anyone who might be interested in preserving Southern heritage and culture would not have an opportunity to get a temporary injunction to stop the removal of the statues, which were obviously done in a very surreptitious and illegal fashion, in direct violation of the Tennessee Heritage Act, and certainly against the interest and the will of the people of Tennessee. So at 9:01 p.m., they had already removed the first statue, and by 10, the second. Now, I got wind of this as soon as the city council meeting was over. I got a phone call from a Shield Wall Network member who was there in Tennessee telling me about it, and I had just begun seeing live feeds on Twitter and on Facebook telling me about it, and people were saying, what's up? Because, back in Crossville at the Stormfront Conference, I had discussed with Dr. Michael Hill and Commander Ike Baker of the League of the South the possibility that over the winter we would continue the activism that had begun through 2017 summer and fall, and not doing, as Dr. Hill said, typically military campaigns will slow down during the winter and there's a fighting season and a resting season, but we wanted to make sure that we keep up the momentum that we built up throughout the year, and we planned on having more demonstrations and protests and rallies throughout the winter as well. And that's why the Shield Wall Network Phalanx continues to grow and to outfit itself with new gloves and new boots and new uniforms and new shields and new helmets. And we're planning on having more training sessions for the defensive arm of the Shield Wall Network, the Phalanx. The next one's coming up January the 20th. So right in the middle of winter, we're going to continue our tactical training, learning our formations and our drills for the Shield Wall Phalanx. And as I talked with Ike Baker and with Dr. Hill, one of the places that we actually discussed holding a demonstration during this winter was Memphis at the Nathan Bedford Forrest statue. And I pledged to them then, there, without any equivocation, that if the League of the South and the Traditionalist Worker Party and their allies, the Nationalist Front, decided to hold a demonstration or rally in Memphis, that they could certainly count on the Shield Wall Network to be there and to stand with them and to back them up, because Memphis is right on the cusp of our home territory. It's our backyard, so to speak, and so we could offer the assistance of some people locally on the ground. One of those local people on the ground, a Shield Wall Network Phalanx member, actually called me on the phone Wednesday, just as the city council was closing the meeting, and asked me what he should do. He was already in the area. And as they got together, as they joined together, the Sons of Confederate Veteran Cucks issued a stand-down order to their own members, saying that they should not go near the statues because the police would be hyped up and, just like they said at Nuremberg, following orders and interested in trying to arrest anyone who tried to slow the removal or protested the removal of the two statues. Well, I'm not the Sons of Confederate Veterans. I'm Billy Roper, and this is not the Sons of Confederate Veterans, Cucks. This is the Shield Wall Network. And so I told my Shield Wall Network guys to head on over there. I told them to be careful and to not get arrested if they could help it, but to talk to the media, to give interviews, which they did, to take plenty of pictures of the law enforcement officers, of the construction workers who were also just following orders, removing the statues and of the whole operation, including the statues themselves being removed, and they did. And then they gave me a full report of how things went down. Now, basically, the controlled media narrative is somewhat accurate. It was not as popular a move as they want to portray it as being, though, because there were some white people who came out to protest, and the police pushed them back two blocks away from the statues to try to keep them from slowing the removal. And so, like I said, that night, before they could even file a temporary injunction, even though January the 16th, a special meeting had been called to discuss the statues, the city council was successful in removing the statues of Nathan Bedford Forrest and Jefferson Davis from the public parks, which had been sold to that private anti-white entity in Memphis, Tennessee. So it's a very sad day, but you know, more than sadness, I feel anger and frustration, but I know that these are the growing pains that we will face as they want to make us extinct, ladies and gentlemen. They want to kill us all. They want your grandkids to all be mulattoes or faggots. And so along the way to genocide, on the way to extinction as a people, we're going to have to face the fact that they're going to take down a few statues. They're going to deface some monuments. They're going to try to wipe out our history and our heritage and our culture and to erase us as a people with an identity before they physically and genetically and biologically erase us and genocide us as a people. That is part and parcel of what genocide is. Just like the Chinese occupation of Tibet and the erasure of Tibetan cultural and religious traditions there was a form of genocide, even though the Tibetan people still exist. It's true that genocide is also the erasure of the culture and the heritage and the history of a people in attempts to destroy their sense of identity and to replace those people with another people. That's also genocide. And that's exactly what's happened in Memphis. Now, when America balkanizes, when it breaks up, I look forward to the day when the free state of Franklin and Ozarkia meet in the smoldering ashes of Memphis after we have besieged it, after we have blockaded it, and after we have starved it out. And I hope that Jim Strickland and the other members of the City Council of Memphis stay very safe for the next few years. I hope they take care of themselves. I hope they eat well and they exercise and they get the best possible medical care that they can get. Because I want them to stay alive. I want them to stay healthy. I want them to live to see the breakup of America, and I want them to face justice. Not the kind of justice that happens in the darkness of night, hiding from people, holding meetings after hours. But the kind of justice that happens on public squares, under the shade of trees and lampposts. The kind of justice that is a public event where everyone is mandated to attend and to see what happens to traitors. The kind of justice which will be televised throughout the region and, if possible, around the world. So I hope that Mayor Strickland and the Memphis City Council take very good care of themselves until America balkanizes, so that we can show them what true justice is. And just like they raise those statues off of their pedestals, we will raise them off of their feet and let them dangle for a while too. So I published the report that was offered to me by the Shield Wall Phalanx members there in Memphis who followed my directions to go and witness the removal of the statues. And now the Tennessee State Legislature, the Tennessee government, is going to sue the city of Memphis for their removal of statues under cover of darkness in complete circumvention of the Tennessee Heritage Act. The fact is, I'm sorry to say, the statues are already gone. So the way that they did it was to already have the statues removed and gone they knew they'd be sued by the state of Tennessee. You know, the Tennessee House Majority Leader and the Attorney General are all saying they'll sue them. Well, great, but the statues are already gone. I mean, it's kind of like, as we say here in the South, you know, shutting the hen house door once the fox is already in there. It's a done deal. So they're not going to bring the statues back. But what the removal of statues have accomplished is to further enrage and to alienate and to polarize whites in Tennessee, but in the Arkansas and Missouri and Mississippi regions surrounding Tennessee as well, and helping them to understand that our very identity as a people is being attacked and removed and replaced. And whether they understand the word or not, they know what is happening. It's genocide. And that brings us one step closer to the inevitable civil war which is coming to America. That civil war which will end in justice for our people and justice for the traitors who have betrayed us. Now, the turnover of these parks to the private entity and the removal of the Nathan Bedford Forest and the Jefferson Davis statues is not the only thing happening. And it's not the only activity that the Shieldwall Network Phalanx is involved in. As I said, we've got the tactical training session coming up on January the 20th, after everyone has a chance to recover from the holidays. And our PT, our physical training individually, continues on a local basis in between now and then. But we do, of course, want to tell everyone who might be interested in getting involved in the Shieldwall Phalanx that they can go to ArianWarrior.com and click on the shield to go to the Shieldwall Network website. They can read what we're involved in, one of the things I'll talk to you about in just a minute. But first, they need to be aware of the fact that not every white person is eligible for Shieldwall Phalanx membership. Not even every white heterosexual. Not even every racially conscious white heterosexual. Only white, heterosexual, racially conscious males are eligible for Shieldwall Phalanx membership. Not to be misogynistic or sexist, but we are a defensive arm of the larger, bigger tent Shieldwall Network, and so ladies will not be involved in the defensive arm of the Shieldwall Network, the Shieldwall Phalanx. Also, one cannot be a current user of any illegal drugs or currently be involved in any illegal activity. Let me reiterate, we do not allow the use of any illegal drugs or participation in any illegal activity. That includes even the discussion of illegal activities or even joking about illegal activities in the Shieldwall Phalanx. But one of the things that we do try to encourage as part of the Shieldwall Network, even if you are not at this time interested in getting involved in the defensive arm, the Phalanx, is resource location and allocation in your area. But what does that mean? Obviously, many of us drive through life back and forth to work and school and socially on autopilot. We don't really notice a lot of times the things that are around us, infrastructure and resources. But we should, because ultimately, when America balkanizes, when the federal government experiences a vacuum of power or an absence of the will to exercise their power, then power will devolve to the local level. And cities like Memphis and Little Rock will be, if they're not blockaded, if they're not besieged, the sources of many refugees filtering out into the surrounding more rural white areas. And if we can block fuel and food from going into those areas, and if we can block those refugees, then that will be the best position for our people to be in, the best tactics and strategy for our local leaders and politicians to take. And if we have become, through the Shieldwall Network program, persons of influence in our communities, then we'll be able to advocate for that protection of our local populations and be able to take over those resources. Now, imagine, if you will, a scenario where there's a vacuum of power at the federal level, where there's a natural disaster or a war or an economic collapse or any other trigger scenario that removes the ability or the willingness of the federal government to get involved or to help, and power devolves back to the local level, and you find yourself being asked by your local county sheriff, along with other citizens in the area, to help defend from thieves and looters some of the local resources in your area. Would you be able to locate and properly defend the institutional resources in your area if you were called upon to do so? Would you be able to keep them from being stripped bare by thieves and looters and refugees swarming in hordes from the outside? If you had to, would you be able to relocate those resources and assets to more defensible areas? These are the questions that we ask ourselves as part of the Showall Network as we face the coming breakdown of civilization and society and the natural order which now exists through government. As we ask ourselves these questions, these topical references to resource location and allocation become ever more pertinent. So, over the next couple of weeks, I'd like for each of you who are interested in getting involved in the Shieldwall Network to go to arianwarrior.com or to shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com and read the back issues on the Shieldwall Network website. Read about what is the Shieldwall Network, finding like-minded people, the role of the Shieldwall Phalanx, and what is the Shieldwall Network plan, Project New America, which discusses that coming balkanization and breakup of the United States. But your homework, after you read that, please, would be to read resource allocation and to think over the Christmas and New Year's holidays as you're off work or school for your local area. Research. Where are the nearest of these resources and assets to your personal location? Think about where the nearest locations are of non-perishable food distribution centers and food warehouses. Think about the nearest location to you of water treatment facilities. Think about the nearest sources of live water, such as rivers and creeks and lakes to you that can be treated. Think about the nearest electric power production facilities to you. Think about the nearest propane and natural gas storage facilities to you. Think about the nearest gasoline storage facilities and the nearest National Guard armories to you. When the collapse happens, those who are able to feed themselves and their neighbors and their fellow citizens and provide access to the other above-mentioned resources will become the persons of influence in their communities. If you can feed a man and feed his family, then he's going to do what you say. He's going to follow your orders and your directions and your suggestions, if you're subtle and diplomatic about it. And he will help you defend your communities and to make them into white nationalist communities. So after you locate the nearest locations to you of each of those resources, in the next phase, I'd like for you to research what would be necessary to secure and defend each of those sites from looters. Once again, completely legally, we're not outlaws, but if you were called upon by local county sheriffs or law enforcement officials to help them, if you were deputized to help defend and to protect food warehouses or electrical production facilities, how would you do so? Think about the roads and the rail lines and the waterways accessing them, existing security emplacements that are already there and how they could be improved. And then that final phase, consider what kind of transportation resources would be needed to move those resources, if possible, for those that are movable, to another more defensible location where applicable, and how those means of transportation may be accessed near you. Eventually and inevitably, Shieldwall Phalanx training will expand into wargaming exercises based on the defense of these kinds of locations from thieves and looters for the good of the community that we live in at large and for the distribution of these resources to the community under our supervision in a shit-hit-the-fan scenario as America balkanizes. So these are considerations I'd like for you to think about just as you drive around in your local communities. Think about where non-perishable food is stored, where your power comes from, where your water supply comes from, and how these resources and assets can be located and defended, and where possible, relocated when America breaks down and when your local area no longer has law and order. And it's up to you to feed and defend your community. These are the things that we plan for as part of the Shield Wall Network. Now, if you'd like to get involved in preparation as a white nationalist for what may be coming, I encourage you to visit the Shield Wall Network website at arianwarrior.com or to email me, Billy Roper, at roper_billy@yahoo.com. Once again, that's roper_billy@yahoo.com. One of the considerations that we need to think about in terms of the coming balkanization of America is the presence of the United Nations and peacekeeping troops in our country. Obviously, if we live in a rural, white area, that's less of a threat than if we happen to live in the Northeast or someplace like the Mid-Atlantic states. But unfortunately, it is a consideration for all of us, depending on how bad the crisis trigger scenario is and how long-lasting the situation continues. We have seen United Nations peacekeepers used throughout the world, especially when there is a civil war or a constitutional crisis or a failure of local and regional government. But whether the trigger for the breakup of the United States is an economic downturn, a natural disaster, or large-scale riots, an insurrection, or external war, a secession movement maybe by sanctuary states, which the federal government simply lacks the will to forcefully oppose, or whatever it may be, the result will be a vacuum of power in some regions, or from all regions, from the national level. So state and local governments are going to then become more autonomous, and in some cases, completely independent. And they'll be free then to form new alliances, or even probably desperate to do so. This is why we consider combat and militia exercises as one of the future evolvements, the evolutionary paths that we're going to take as part of the Shield Network and the Phalanx. Because ultimately, we will have to defend ourselves and our families and our communities, if not from UN peacekeepers, then from looters and thieves, or from potentially starving refugees. If you've ever seen those scenes in any zombie apocalypse movie where the whole city goes zombie and starts to attack, then that's what a lot of American cities and suburbs will look like when America balkanizes. So we need to prepare to defend ourselves and not eschew our fear, firearms or ammunition or that kind of tactical training, which is part and parcel of being a white nationalist prepper. Because ultimately, the true patriots may be those who are fighting United Nations peacekeeping invaders. When America begins to balkanize, you know, some of those locations will invite in outside help. And this is in reference to a recent article about Chicago. As all of you know, who've listened to the Roper Report and read the stats, Chicago is facing an epidemic of black-on-black violence, shootings, and drive-bys, massacres at birthday parties, and really every day, blacks are killing each other with firearms in Chicago, and it's not going to end anytime soon, even though Chicago has some of the most strict anti-gun laws of anywhere in the United States. Well, blacks not being able to accept personal responsibility for anything ever want to blame everyone else. They want to blame guns or blame white supremacism, blame Trump, and they want to try to always give me's. They want to get help from the outside, in this case from the United Nations. But whether it's those large Chinese communities on the West Coast from Vancouver to the San Francisco Bay Area including the Pacific Northwest, where they're the largest growing population, and they may invite in Chinese humanitarian efforts spearheaded by the Chinese military, which will, you know, generously offer to aid and assist there, since the U.S. government at that time will no longer be able to guarantee the safety of Chinese citizens living on the West Coast or, you know, further south. Mexican majority areas in Southern California or in the border states all the way to Texas may invite in Mexican army protection or even cartel forces to provide quote-unquote security. Now, if Canada is less affected, they may be asked to help by overwhelmed local officials in the Great Lakes region. But perhaps one of the most concerning to any American is a potential threat by United Nations peacekeeping troops coming into their towns, rolling in with their blue helmets and their tanks. But the good news, you know, is that they'd likely prioritize their missions to secure the densely populated, diverse Mid-Atlantic region from Boston to Richmond. Megalopolis and other urban islands would be more than they could handle, really, as their experience trying to control the antagonist during the Yugoslavian Civil War demonstrated. In terms of thinking like our enemies do, what then would be the mission goals of the United Nations peacekeepers? Number one, probably controlling the national capital for the appearance of legitimacy and acting in concert with the rump state of the remnant federal government. Secondarily, this also would allow the multinational forces involving free access to every remaining U.S. intelligence resource and asset, cleaning out the cabinets, including every military and technology secret which the federal government maintained. And tertiarily, thirdly, those regions still ostensibly loyal to the federal government would become tacitly under their control indirectly as well. Number two, United Nations peacekeeping forces would graciously take into their protective custody stockpiles and deposits of precious metals and items of value from art to industry. Yeah, their protective custody, right? So this organized removal for safekeeping would outstrip individual looting by a long way by the peacekeepers themselves. And much of this would be shipped back home to wherever they came from. And, you know, the makeup of the UN peacekeepers, whether they were from the EU or from African nations or from India or China, etc., would dictate largely where they ended up, as well as how the native population in the area would be treated. You can imagine how a bunch of Indian or African troops, even wearing blue helmets, would treat white women in occupied zones of America. Just like the Allies treated German women in 1945. Now, taxation of those local resources, including crops and livestock and labor, would increasingly be protected to offset the peacekeepers' expenses for services rendered, because the U.S., remember, would not be paying in to the U.N. any longer. And this would result in a feudal system of subservience to the foreign occupiers, because the loss of the United States as a consumer market and as a producer market would probably create a global recession economically. They'd have to make that up somehow. So as happened in the former Yugoslavia, and so many other places where the United Nations, the UN, blue helmets have intervened, the rising ethno-states in a balkanized America might find themselves in direct conflict with those blue helmets, even to the extent of being bombed and attacked militarily, just like we did under the auspices of the UN to Serbia under Bill Clinton. I remember when I was in college protesting U.S. bombing of Serbia and the United Nations intervention there. So the United Nations occupiers, whether they call themselves peacekeepers or not here in the U.S., will be our enemies. And some may believe, you know, that the potential involvement of UN peacekeepers in the United States is far-fetched, kind of like a tinfoil hat conspiracy theory. I'm not looking out the window at blue helicopters or worried about being carted off to a FEMA camp tomorrow, but it's a realistic possibility. Because even now, some local officials in areas of America where law and order have broken down already are inviting them in. Now, I'm talking specifically about Chicago, like I said, where the Cook County Commissioner said that leaders in Chicago and Cook County have failed to protect the black community from violent crime. And he actually went to the United Nations and spoke to the United Nations head for peacekeeping forces. This is from CBS Chicago. Some politicians in the past have recommended deploying the National Guard to help Chicago quell gun violence, but Cook County Commissioner Richard Boykin went even further on Thursday, suggesting the United Nations perhaps send in peacekeepers in the face of what he called, listen to this term, a quiet genocide. He made this recommendation while meeting with the United Nations official in charge of peacekeeping missions. Now, imagine, if you will, if the federal government was severely weakened and couldn't or wouldn't say no. Now prepare to shoot at blue helmets when America goes down, because that may very well be what we have to do. And that's why the Shield Wall Phalanx, the defensive arm of the Shield Wall Network, is beginning now with tactical training. We're not going to be running around in the woods with guns. At first, we're going to learn to trust one another face-to-face and to act as small units with discipline and with order and establish our chain of command, our NCOs and our officers, as we expand our membership and grow as an organization, as well as a defensive arm. Ultimately, however, we will be looking at other tactical exercises as we evolve into the defensive arm, not only for the Shield Wall Network, but indeed for our local communities as well. And when America goes down, when the United States balkanizes, the Shield Wall Phalanx and other allied militias and 3%ers, including other white nationalists, will stand ready to defend our communities against any enemy, whether foreign or domestic. So if you think that you have what it takes to defend your community, if you think that you have the intelligence and the will and the courage to defend your community and to become a person of influence in your community now, before America breaks up, then I encourage you to join me and so many others in getting involved with the Shield Wall Network, and if you're willing, the Shield Wall Phalanx. We're not just looking for former law enforcement or military veterans, but any man, any white man, any heterosexual white man, any racially conscious heterosexual white man who's not stoned out of his gourd and talking about blowing up buildings, looking for you to join the Shield Wall Network and the Shield Wall Phalanx. So as more and more cities like Memphis take down the statues and monuments representing our heritage and our culture, we move closer and closer to civil war and ethnic strife. More and more of our people are waking up, moving out of those black areas according to the Shield Wall plan, and recongregating, voting with their feet, coming to Ozarkia, coming to Franklin, coming to New Albion, coming to the Pacific Northwest, gathering together once again in these rising white ethnostates in preparation for the new dawn. The new dawn that is about to break just to the east, rising above the hills. As we prepare for 2018 and we think about what the new year will bring, I want all of you to think about yourselves and your families and your communities and what will happen when America goes down. Will you stand alone? Will you try to be a hermit? Will you be a refugee? Will you bug out or will you stand in place? Will you be willing to join together with your fellow white men and women and defend your communities? If you are, join me in the Shield Wall Network. Email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com and I'll tell you how you can get started today. Until next week, which will be 2018, for the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast. As always, this is your host, Billy Roper, reminding you to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain? We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fire acts out to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're at a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America. The best idea since democracy.
You are listening to Radio Area. For an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArea.com.